Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today we're going to be broadcasting a couple of pieces from the archives. The first is a wonderful interview that I had with Joanna Haygood, one of my favorite choreographers. She is an artistic director of Zako Dance Theater. And this particular interview regarding The Monkey and the Devil was a collaboration with visual artist Charles Traplin. And it was staged at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts back in April 2011. I don't know if you were able to catch it, but it was just really, really fantastic. And there were two houses and two couples, one Caucasian and another African-American. And Rita Feliciano in Dance Magazine wrote a review, and I'm going to just read a little bit of that before jumping right into the interview. And if all things go well, we're going to follow that with a really wonderful piece that I was able to record an interview with Marilyn Bucks, the late Marilyn Bucks, attorney and co-defendant Linda Evans, and others, just talking about her life. And this is before she made her transition. This is before she was released. And so we're going to have a bit of that particular interview. And then we're going to have a couple of live interviews. So it should be really, really cool after that. So stay tuned. It's going to be really great. So according to this, again, this is a review by Rita Feliciano, one of the Bay Area's great dance critics. She writes, "The Monkey and the Devil, a quartet for two couples, one Caucasian and one African-American, is easily Joanne Haygood's most rigorously formal work. It is also devastating in the way it lays bare the festering wounds of racism. Haygood, artistic director of Zako, first showed the piece at her company's studio 2 years ago. Since then, she has added Hold No Punches text that raises the temperature without diminishing the choreographer's potency. A collaboration with visual artist Charles Traplin, Monkey, the title refers to racial slurs, is inspired by Abraham Lincoln saying, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Traplin builds two halves of a house, its interior painted off-white and pale brown. The structures, each supported on a pivot, creaked and groaned in response to the shifts of human bodies inside them. The buildings also could be spun like tops with force applied from the outside. Some of the work's most dramatic episodes concern the couple's desperate attempts to stabilize the ground under their feet, falling, clinging, shoving, and tumbling. They looked as if caught in an earthquake. The audience freely moved around the periphery, imposing its own perspective on these emblems of long-held animosities. Choreographically, Haygood suggested the ritual and violence of a boxing arena with a bell periodically calling for a breather. There would be no winners. Sparring partners remained on equal footing. Each kick, each glare, each raised fist and body smashed against a wall was the shouted, each kick, each glare, each raised fist and body smashed against a wall was a mirror image of the neighbors across a tiny alley. The woman raised their fists identically, shouted the same, I am a woman, at each other. Both huddled in their corners, shaking with rage and sputtering racial insults as if to stroke their anger. They also submitted simultaneously to being measured for the slave market, and they put their shoulders against the neighbor's house to send it in a whirling hurricane. The men, in the meantime, looked on, climbed the walls, and wearily circulated around the enemy. Halfway through the one-hour work, Haygood reversed gears and the men reenacted the women's roles, starting with the mantra, I am a man. They vented their fury in a fist fight and a long diatribe about the failures of the other race. It was interesting to observe that the primarily Caucasian audience stood closer to the African-American man, listening to him more intently. Did they feel they needed to hear what he had to say, or would it have been too uncomfortable to listen to, perhaps, hidden prejudices inside themselves? That's a good question. Punctuating the pristinely coordinated physical confrontations during which the dancers at times often looked programmed were periods of stasis, of blank stares and a fatigue grounded in hopelessness. For these people, the excellent Sean Grimm, Jody Lomask, Risa Simpson, who's been on the air quite a few times, and Matthew Wickett, whom I've been trying to get, there was no exit. They were condemned to the hell of the other, capital O. So, again, that's Rita Feliciano's review of Joanna Haygood's The Monkey and the Devil with, again, collaboration with visual artist Charles Trappolin. And here they are in a wonderful interview that we were able to get with them before the show opened at Yerba Buena. March 6, 2009. So this is the week of, but not, it didn't hadn't happened yet. And I agree with everything that Rita said in her review, and then some.
You are so in my soul, you're in my head. You have taken all my. I catch you as you drum up from the dust. Shall I ride to your grave? Yeah, I must. So today I promise forever, even though today will end, tomorrow may be.
This is Wanda's Picks, the Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network, and that was Toshi Reagan in It Gets Better. And we're joined in the studio today. Joanna, is that you?
That's me.
Okay.
Hey, Wanda.
Hey, Joanna, how are you?
Good.
Yeah,
how are you doing over there?
Oh, I'm doing good. I was getting worried there for a second. So, okay. She's going to come in like exactly on the nose. And yes, you did. Must be that aerial thing, you know, just sort of fly in, like right
fly in and land at 2 o'clock.
Exactly. I'm glad the air was like in your favor because it's really blowing it here in the East Bay. Is it
really windy?
Yeah. Really excited about your new piece that's sort of a query around race. And is this the same piece, The Monkey and the Devil, that Zacco had in, like, preview rehearsals a while back when
yeah.
we had, like, an open
yeah.
studio at the school?
I had it at my studio. I did two
right.
open studios. I think one was in 2007,
oh,
it's eight,
been that long.
Eight,
okay.
eight, maybe eight.
Okay.
And then about a year or so ago,
mm-hmm.
And I've been working on it on and off. I haven't been, you know, working on it continuously since that first time. But I've been working on it on and off, and I've been thinking about it quite a bit and trying to find some opportunities to actually, you know, showcase the work or present the work in a more formal setting. So now it's happening.
Right, yeah, it's really exciting. It sounds really great. Let me let our audience know a little bit about you. Zacco Dance Theater presents, as we said, the internationally acclaimed choreographer Joanna Haygood, Sailing Away, latest performance installation, The Monkey and the Devil, which is going to be premiering at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in the Forum, is that correct?
The Forum, mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, April 15th through 17th. And it was created in collaboration with visual artist Charles Trappolin, and says Joanna's visceral hybrid of dance, theater, and visual art combines contemporary movement, hip hop, element and spoken text in an energetic production that is both searing and immediate. The hour-long work traces contemporary racism with roots in America's slave trade. Performers twist, flip, and pound through interactions fraught with tension and misunderstanding. And I'm going to let you tell us more about it. I'm not going to read the rest of the press release. I might give away.
That was very exciting.
Yeah, wasn't that exciting? Yeah. And you are just phenomenal. You create dance that use natural, architectural, and cultural environments as a point of departure. And I will never get over trying to think. Well, I don't know. I guess all of your theater pieces are so indelible. But I think the first one that I experienced a long time ago was when we were at the various forts in San Francisco,
right.
and you recreated the transatlantic slave trade. I mean, we came into the ports and we were sort of separated according to various characteristics and branded, and then shuffled off, and that was really something. What was that piece called?
That was called Invisible Wings.
Oh, okay, Invisible Wings. All right, yeah. And then when more recently, the piece you did with Culture Odyssey, Redessa and Idris, that was really something at the African American Art and Culture Complex. What was that one called? That was great.
Boy, the moment you said that, The Breach.
The Breach, yeah, because it brought together the slave trade historically and the slave trade, in its contemporary sense around, different ways we're bound. Society binds us, the legal system binds, we bind ourselves. That was so good. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you. That was really a remarkable experience for me. I mean, working with both Idris and Rodessa was just really great. I mean, they're great thinkers. They're fantastic artists. This was really difficult material, similar to this piece that I'm doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really wonderful to work with people who had so much experience and so much, their process was very thoughtful, and they had been working on these issues for a really long time. So their insights were really valuable, and the dialogue between us was really rich and wonderful. And the piece was, as I say, it was very, very, it was difficult material, and it was really difficult to perform because, a lot of these issues and these historical moments that we were depicting were very harsh, and they really demanded a commitment from all of us, and in a way that would kind of put us in the mindset of those characters that we were trying to portray and their experiences. And it was very, very difficult, but very meaningful as well. And, there's a tremendous amount of learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sort of typically the way, your co-artistic collaborator has joined us. Yeah, Charles, is that you?
Yes, it is. Hi.
Oh, hi. Joanna's on the air as well.
Great.
Hey, Charles.
Hey, Joanna. How are y'all doing?
Oh, good,
it's
good.
Really wonderful. Charles and I haven't spoken to each other in a while. He's just coming in for the show, and we're about to spend a bunch of time together, but this is wonderful to get started. Hello, Charles.
Hi.
Hi from New Orleans.
You're in New Orleans right now?
Yes.
Oh, what's the weather like there? It's windy here in California, Northern California.
It's beautiful. It's been cool and just beautiful weather, and yeah, it's good here. Yeah.
Okay, wow. This is a perfect segue, Joanna, because we were talking about collaborations.
Yes, we were.
And we call you into the studio. That is so cool. Yeah, David. Wow, Charles. It was like you heard us. Yeah.
Great.
Well, let me tell the audience a little bit about you, Charles. See, you are a visual and performance artist whose work has been seen at the Oakland Museum, the San Jose Museum of Contemporary Art, SOMAR, and John Sims Center for the Arts. Your work is in permanent collection in the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok, Thailand, following the creation of The Maze at Burning Man at Black Rock City, Nevada in 2000. You were commissioned to create a 300 foot mural and installations for the Maze of Reflection in 2001. More recently, your work was selected for Sculpture by the Sea in Bonny Beach, Sydney, Australia. You travel a lot.
a bit.
Yeah. As a professional dancer, you were a member of the highly acclaimed dance company ODC, San Francisco, performing throughout the United States. Since 2002, you have been a partner in Teatro Zenzani. Your awards and accreditations include nominations for the Isadora Duncan Dance Award in 1998 and the SECA Award at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in 2002. Joanna, why don't you bring Charles into the conversation and talk about sort of the collaborative piece in this, the Monkey and the Devil, and how you two came to work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, Charles, you can chime in whenever you like.
Okay.
Well, Charles and I met each other I'm not even exactly sure how many years ago, but many, when we were both in
30.
Maybe 30 years ago, when we were in our prime dancing and performing. And I think at the time I may have been dancing with Margaret Jenkins and you were dancing with ODC.
Yes.
But we were often around the same studio, dancing around each other in one way or another. And then I have always admired Charles. He was a fantastic, beautiful, extraordinary dancer. And then Charles had moved on and decided to pursue a career in visual art making and performance of different kinds. And we kind of lost touch for a while and eventually came back together. You know, we saw each other at a show. I think that I was performing and that you had an installation in the lobby. We made our commitments that we would try to hook up together and make something together. And then eventually a few years after that, we met up again around Teatro Zenzani, where I was doing a benefit for my youth program. And then we started spending more time together and said, you know, this was about the time that we needed to really solidify this commitment to make something together. So we did, and it was a really kind of organic process in that we didn't decide what we were going to do on the first meeting. We just decided to spend time together and talk about our histories and see where things went. And at some point after probably a few months, wouldn't you say, Charles?
I'm not exactly sure, but are you talking about when we discovered our joint histories?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think was a little bit of a surprise for, I think, both of us that Joanna's family comes from, were slaves outside of Charleston, and my family had a plantation outside of Charleston. And that sort of shared ground, but from two sides of the fence, really sparked sort of this really interesting and exciting sort of collaboration that has turned into the Monkey and the Devil. So I think I actually remember that it came up fairly quickly once we really started to sit down and talk about the piece.
Mm-hmm. Who we were.
Yeah.
And our individual histories. So as you can see, you know, it's been a while. This piece has been in process and has been performed a couple of times, as you mentioned earlier, Wanda. But this feels almost as if, in some ways, it's the piece is really coming out now. It's been prepared and ruminated over and adjusted and explored. And not to say that I think that it is finished. I'm sure there'll be tinkering beyond this point. But
right, yeah. So Charles, where do you enter the work as a visual artist, as a performance artist, or both? Or
well, I both. First off, it was fantastic working with Joanna, and just the collaboration and the feedback, and seeing, you know, seeing her work and understanding it more, you know, after all these years. But since I had a pretty significant experience as a performer, a dancer, I came to it with a visual eye, but with an understanding of movement and sets, and sets that were more functional than necessarily just the trappings of something happening. And I'm, you know, what I made, they pushed beyond what I envisioned, which sometimes was scary for me, but it basically was really exciting. And to see, you know, this, you know, I came to it with, as we were talking, this, I don't even know how it entered my head, but the Lincoln phrase, a house divided cannot stand unto itself, or I don't even know the exact quote right at the moment. But and also I was looking at an artist, Gordon Mata Clark, who did these sculptures that basically were sections of houses that were cut out, or he had divided a house in two. And so there was this sense, and also in dealing with race issues as a white man, there really was a sense of some instability, some sort of, you know, a little bit of a shaky ground, because it is a bit more, you know, I feel I need to walk a little bit more ginger through the conversation. But, you know, so the set itself, you know, it moves, and also there's a quality that you can never really see everything in the piece because of its moving. And, you know, there are times where the structure, which are basically two pieces of houses, they're two corners, each has a window. So it's two walls and a floor that are sitting on a steel post. So they're imbalanced and they turn. And so at some points you can only see one set of performers, and, you know, how Joanna has structured the piece and the soundscape. I can't wait to see this version because I haven't seen it for a while. Really informed a lot of how this sort of thing happened that I'm part of. I don't know how. Thank you, Joanna, by the way.
Thank you.
Wow. I was wondering, Joanna, how does one, you know, sort of question racism? You say racism hasn't disappeared. Find out where it's been living. So then, Charles, when you mentioned the set, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, you have like this, sounds like sort of like a house kind of structure, and you think you're alone, but you really aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the image, you know, of the monkey and the devil, it's got, you know, this man facing out, and then you've got these arms of this woman, you know, sort of something looks like she's putting something on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, so Joanna, could you talk a little bit about the process of sort of questioning this particular sort of abstract concept, and how you make it concrete, you know, in the choreography? And you have other collaborations, you know, with some artists like Sean Grimm, Jody Lomask, Risa Simpson, Matthew Wickett, and Kim Ewell, you mentioned. So if you could talk about sort of how do you work in making something so abstract, concrete, and how do you involve the audience? Because I know one thing about your work is there's no passivity. I mean, the audience is not watching. You know, we're engaged and we're involved, and are we walking around? I mean, how does it work? And, you know, how is it in this particular piece?
Well, the piece is the content of what the dancers are doing, and really the piece in general is really based on this notion that racism exists everywhere in the United States and within most people. And I'd say really, like, it's hard to find anyone who is not impacted or participating in one way or another in racialization or racism here in the United States. It's difficult to escape given that our social structures have been supported by racist activities and behaviors in our neighborhoods and in our schools and our representation and media and in the way that we think and perceive each other. So that's kind of the basis from which we've then moved forward to explore, you know, some of these ideas. And there are many ways that this manifests. I mean, you know, we have stereotypes. We have, you know, our own feelings of aggression and oppression, anger. We look at these false sciences, how people justify their opinions or how they create, you know, these false sciences in order to you know, create a belief system for people to run their lives by. We look at how these activities are very do create an instability in our society and within, you know, the idea that we are, you know, one nation. I mean, there's so much inequity, you know, that stems from racism that there is no way that we can create a balanced relationship, you know, when that is the kind of the underlying agenda, you know, is to keep one more powerful than the other. So anyway, so there are lots of areas that we look at, and also kind of the distortion of what that creates in people and their own views of the world in general. So the piece structure is that there's a white couple and a black couple, and the structure of the choreography is somewhat symmetrical. So it's a very kind of complicated thing because the way racism manifests here is not necessarily an equitable thing. I mean, you know, blacks, even though they participated in slave, you know, as being slaveholders, they were, you know, they weren't the primary slaveholders in this country. It was, you know, a very small minority, but it was a system that was created by whites to advance their, you know, economics and their social status and political power. And, you know, black people don't have a history of lynching whites, although there have been black-on-white crimes. But there was a large movement of people, you know, lynching blacks. So there's that part. But I think the piece tries to look at racism as a psychology, and it doesn't it doesn't completely weigh in. There are some places where you can see that there are imbalances even between the couples, but it looks at the psychology for wherever it comes from, you know, around racism and how both sides participate and both sides and how important it is for both sides to actually own that and to let it go and to find ways to move beyond it in order to start the healing. Now, that said, you know, the thing that's complicated is we live in a system right now where people of color are still actively oppressed in our education systems, in our social justice, in our justice system, and there are many, you know, so many social environments where people are not getting ahead, and, you know, and so I think that it charges the performance in that way. But right now I feel that you can still acknowledge that in the piece, and you can still come to it and look at it in this way that, you know, that even, you know, people, me being a person of color, I need to check my own racist attitudes too. And I need to reach and grow beyond that too. And that's not to say that I do not want to, you know, that it's not important to work for social justice causes, because those things have to happen in tandem. They have to happen together. So,
And I think that one of the things that for me, I hope you don't mind me jumping in.
No, do.
I think that one of the interesting things for me about the piece and how Joanna approached it was that, you know, she mentioned sort of this symmetry, and for me to see a piece on racism where it actually does not only acknowledge but actually goes into sort of the dual racism that, you know, that as we're moving forward trying to do, you know, do our individual work and political work and social work to move our communities and our you know, families or whoever forward, that there is this dual racism that she so clearly pulls out, hence the monkey and the devil, that I haven't really seen something like that before, and I was very intrigued by it, that there was her vision could incorporate both the racism that African Americans face, you know, all the time, but also the racism that Caucasians or whites face. And so it's this mirrored, it's sort of a mirrored hatred of the other. And, you know, you see that so often in our society and in the world now. It's just this terrible, you know, hatred of the other. And it comes from such a ignorant, uninformed place. I didn't see in the piece, unless there has been some change, resolution of, you know, what do we do with this? You know, we can acknowledge it and look at it, but how do we, beyond our personal, you know, stance, you know, have resolution? I don't know. You know, I can do my work, my own work, but I don't know beyond that. So.
Well, I think I don't think the piece offers resolution per se, other than I'm hoping that people will inspire a lot of conversation. We're having an area of this space where people can talk about their own stories. There'll be a facilitator there who will help people articulate their own feelings, not just about the piece, but their draw from their own experiences. And it is such a complicated issue. I don't even know if it issue is even a right way to label it. I mean, it's just permeated pretty much everything. And you know, the thing about the piece is that it's, you know, you could put gay and straight people in this piece. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like
right.
You look at it, you go, oh, you know, this could be men and women. There's like a little layer of, you know, sexism. I mean,
it could be like Muslims and yeah.
And it is, as Charles said, it's this fear of other, and you know, and at the same time, it's also it's also about power, you know, and how do we maintain power? Well, power doesn't really come in, you know, real power in my mind doesn't really come from oppressing. It comes from collaboration, and you know, it's as if you have gained more arms and legs when you work together, you know, a bigger mind. But we have been really taught the opposite. And you know, to our own demise, really. And now we're starting to see, you know, racism. People expressing their racist attitudes more readily. There was a period, you know, where people were so, you know, after the civil rights movement, and where people were really really work to kind of keep their attitudes behind closed doors. And I think that gave the impression to many that these attitudes had actually gone away. But, I mean, we know that it's not true, just even like when we look at our you know, as I mentioned earlier, our education and our social systems. I mean, there were so many areas in where racism has been practiced.
Mm-hmm.
But now, in, you know, our post-Obama era, we're seeing people actually come out again and being more overt about their opinions and their actions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we would look just in Arizona, you know.
Yeah, I want to let our audience know we're speaking to Joanna Haygood and Charles H. Travelin about The Monkey and the Devil, a performance installation about racism that is going to be debuting at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts Forum. April 15th, performance is 8 to 9 p.m., and then from 9 to 10, there's a post-performance discussion with social justice advocates from across California. And then April 16th through 17th, performances are 12 to 2 p.m. and 3 to 5 p.m. in one-hour cycles. And the forum at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts is located at 701 Mission Street in San Francisco. You can call 415-822-6744 for more information, or you can visit zacco.org or ybca.org for information. And it says, Joanna and Charles, that parental guidance is suggested for youth under 13. Why is that?
Well, the piece is not overtly violent,
mm-hmm.
but it is. There are places where it's really aggressive, and it's really noisy,
mm-hmm.
and it's really chaotic. And I've noticed that some younger kids are very uncomfortable, and it's a lot to understand. I think that. I think that, you know, people have to, they know their own children and what they're able to handle. I think that this is a great opportunity for young teens to work as a catalyst for a good conversation with them about these concepts. I'm not sure whether or not younger kids, because it is, and it's not even just so much that it is aggressive in that way too. It's very abstract, so I'm not sure whether or not the younger kids will get enough out of it, other than it's very scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
But you know, as I say, people know their children, and they, you know, every child is different, and I don't want to discourage people from bringing their children, but I just think that it's more appropriate for older kids.
Right. Yeah. And your youth program, 19 years old now, right? Your youth academy.
Yes, 20. Yeah. 20.
Years. Wow, it's a long time you've been in Bayview.
I know.
That is so wonderful. Didn't your kids have a performance like a week ago?
They did. They had a performance at the new ODC Theater.
Oh, nice. How was it?
It was really fantastic. They made some really powerful pieces about, oddly enough, about racial profiling and gang life and environmental issues and media saturation and identity. And they worked with had visits from a number of youth organizations around Bayview and San Francisco, where kids would come into the studio and see the work, and they'd have conversations about it. In one case, they collaborated on a film about the BP oil spill and environmental issues and environmental justice. And it was very empowering for them, and it was also very inspiring for me and for the adults in the room to see these young people give, you know, a really clear voice to their feelings and their experiences. They, we did a panel afterwards that was, you know, again, just great to, you know, it's great to hear the kids articulate, you know, how they're feeling. And yeah, it was a really great experience. And I'm very eager to get their thoughts about this piece mm-hmm. now. I haven't seen any of the rehearsals or anything, so.
Yeah. So with regards to this panel on the 15th, which is Friday, and then you mentioned that people have an opportunity to sort of reflect on how this piece impacts them, you know, sort of the things that they're thinking. So after the panel on Saturday, Sunday, is someone going to be there so they can, you know, talk to someone about how they're feeling about the sort of
yeah.
the okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there'll be some on the Saturday and Sunday. There'll be a facilitator.
Oh,
be an area where people can sit and talk. There'll be, I'm not sure if this will happen on both days. I think one day will be in an area, in the theater area, and then one day will be up in another area in the building, upstairs on the second floor. It's a very nice open room, but it'll give people an opportunity to, you know, to just, as you say, reflect and to think about, you know, how they're feeling about what they have seen, and also to have an opportunity to share their own experiences, because I think that that's really important. You know, there are all these new phenomena happening around color blindness, and someone actually told me, what is it called, like the millennium race, it's a millennium race syndrome, or whereby they're, like, for instance, I'll give an example where I was working with these young performers, and, you know, they came into the room on the first day to say, you know, this doesn't really affect us. We grew up in a completely different environment where race was not really on our, you know, kind of social radar. We went to mixed schools, and, you know, I had black friends, or I had white friends, I had, you know, all kinds of friends, gay, straight, you know, all colors, and we just don't think about it in the same way. And then, you know, it's like, well, that's so interesting, because, you know, I was born in the 50s and grew up in the 60s, and race was, you know, primary issue. I mean, everything was identified by race in that period. So I thought that was really fascinating. But after weeks went on, you know, there were so much that slowly got revealed about how race actually was affecting their lives, and they had just, they weren't able to identify it really, or they were simply ignoring it. And I think that's also very interesting. So, you know, when, you know, I mean, I'm working in Bayview, and, you know, the kids are really struggling. You know, they're fabulous kids. They're really struggling because there's, you know, the school system is not really serving them. You know, and it is built on a, you know, on this system that has basically, you know, come from the architects of on race. You know, it's so over the years, you know, things have never been improved. They've only gotten worse, although, you know, they're not able to, they don't really understand the history and how it got there and how it stays there. And so they're not able to give it, they're not able to give it labels or identifiers. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So, so anyway, so there's a lot of education that needs to be had, and I just hope that this piece is, you know, a catalyst for some meaningful conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to go back to your and Charles's conversation about your joint histories and that overlap there, and I want to throw in a term, privilege, and another one, Entitlement. And just sort of thinking about, you know, the whole idea of race, racism, and bigotry. And I've always been of the mind that the black people couldn't be racist because racism implies that you can change a structure, and it's not just, you know, having, you know, ill will toward another race that's not your own, but you can actually do something about it. Whereas bigotry for me is if you dislike someone based solely on, you know, something like race or another sort of component of their person, just because it is what it is, not that because you know it or you've had an interaction. I was wondering if you could talk more about your shared geographical history, and maybe even closer, and, you know, sort of in light of that term, like privilege.
And you can, Wanda, can I just ask you a question? So you're saying,
yeah,
you're saying bigotry is more about our kind of inherent attitudes, and the racism actually is more about action.
About
and,
power, yeah.
And power and politics. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah.
Well, I'm from New Orleans, and I moved back here a year and a half ago, and I think that those distinctions for me, being back in New Orleans, I have felt in some ways, you know, I lived in San Francisco for 27 years, and it's such a progressive city, but the amount of racism or bigotry that I have personally felt, just sheerly because I'm, you know, I have a different colored skin, has been really amazing to me. You know, but also the poverty and the lack of education and the lack of opportunity are enormous here for African Americans. So this sense of privilege in relationship to it, I think that the sense of privilege or entitlement, which is a very different word, but I'm going to stick with privilege. I don't necessarily feel privileged, even though I have been privileged in my life comparatively. You know, I had good education. But the nature of racism for me is this sheer hatred and of someone because of their color, or, you know, or bigotry. I'm not completely clear on the difference in myself between, you know, how you're defining it. You know, my family owned slaves, and there is, you know, I have sat with that and sort of dealt with that. And, you know, my father and his brother were, you know, my uncle were very involved in the civil rights movement down here. Yet at the same time, I do have this heritage of coming from slave owners. You know, my great grandfather in his autobiography or his memoirs said, well, we were good slave owners. Well, I don't know that there were good slave owners. They owned people, and they used people for their wealth. You know, talk about entitlement and privilege. You know, so I don't believe that racism is based on privilege and entitlement for me. I believe that racism is really about, you know, looking at someone and having hate or disdain or dismissal of them clearly, or just not even seeing them because, you know, who they are, because they look different. They have a different color on their body than I have on my body. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know if how that relates to the distinctions that you're trying to make between bigotry and racism, or but for me, that really, you know, it's been palpable. It's been very interesting to return here, and the amount of poverty you know, black on black crime and murder and you know, I don't know how to, beyond what I do, again, in my own work, how to live, I can extend my hand, but I don't know beyond that, you know, this idea of resolution, how do you resolve this? It's so big and so systemic and has, you know, centuries and centuries long. It's very sad to me.
Well, I guess I should weigh in here. I'm not sure. That's a really big question. I mean, you know, I do acknowledge that there is institutionalized racism, and there are, you know, strong arms in politics and in economics, and it's a tool. You know, it's a tool that's used to keep a particular group in a place and to, you know, help, you know, perpetuate the wealth of others. And but I also see it as I see it also as Charles was talking about it, and it's a way that we value each other based on this superficial information. And I think that these are some of the things that make, you know, it's an extremely complicated issue. And you know, and I also see, like, you know, the reason why, you know, the reason why whites historically have been racist has been one reason, and you know, blacks another. You know, I mean, we are fighting against the oppressors. You know, there's anger.
I think it's misguided by the color of the skin.
Yes.
Immediately
yes.
Think that someone's an oppressor.
Now. I mean, that's the thing. But we can't deny that, you know, there is a system still in place where there is. Our world economy is driven by whites. I mean, we still have this small minority, and that is changing, obviously. But I think that we're still reacting. You know, we're still reacting on this history and these patterns, but we're not finding our way out to move beyond it, you know, to make that significant change. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that we are working hard in the social justice areas, you know, to make change, and I think that we have seen some change, but we haven't shifted the psychology. So if we were to reverse it and say that all, you know, people of color were now running the economies of the world and we are, you know, we have finally, you know, reached the mountaintop wherever, example, because that's about something else altogether, but you know, we have finally we have finally made significant progress. Would our attitudes of whites change? Would that change? And that's what I think is an important question. I mean, how do we undo, how do we stop making of, you know, using race as a system of valuing each other? You know, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, there are good people and there are not such good people. You know, there are people who are, you know, and really, I mean, I don't think that anybody would deny it. It's like, is Idi Amin, you know, not evil and cruel and an oppressor? You know, they come in all shapes and sizes and colors. And I think that, you know, going beyond this superficial value system is really important, you know. So, you know, I see, you know, even here during this conversation with three highly educated people, you know, it's hard to find it's hard to find any kind. It's hard to find a direction for resolution because there's so many parts to it. But I think that it's important to discuss it, and I'm looking forward to hearing from people who have looked at this problem, if you will, in a much more comprehensive way, in a much deeper way, for a longer period of time. I'm waiting to be to get some insight to help me reconcile all of these different parts because it's really important. And it's important for all of us to do. So I don't know, Wanda. I'd love to hear from you a little bit about your feelings about these things.
Charles, did you want to say something? I sort of thought you had a comment.
I was sitting here just thinking whether power just corrupts, no matter who you are. You know, and in gaining power, does it make you want to suppress those who are not like you? And that I was just sitting here thinking about that as Joanna was, you know, bring up Idi Amin and, you know, all of the issues involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm actually a New Orleans native myself. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, my whole family's from New Orleans and Mississippi, southern Mississippi. And we came here. I was born in the 50s and grew up in the 60s as well in San Francisco. Went to John McLaren, Visitation Valley Junior High School, and then went to a private high school, grew up in the Nation of Islam. So I went to Muhammad University. And I teach at the College of Alameda, and we're looking at privilege as a theme in my critical thinking class that I teach. And so my students have read Tim Wise, and I've showed them the film, Shakti Butler's film, Mirrors of Privilege, Making Whiteness Visible.
Yeah, we just watched that yesterday, parts of it. Yeah.
Yeah,
she
and
did the studio yesterday, so that's a whole lot.
Oh, for real? She did?
Yeah.
Oh, she has a new film that she's finished with, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, that's great. Yeah, and Charles, I completely agree with you with regards to you do what you can in the sphere of influence that you have, and, you know, you have a wider audience because, you know, you make art that's all over the world. So within your work, similar to what you do, Joanna, within your work you have a larger audience than, you know, regular people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for just a regular person, they might, their sphere of influence might just be their family and maybe their neighbors, whereas with you all, you have audiences that you're impacting that you don't even know. And so raising the question, I think everything starts with a question because I think the answers lie within us. So what I think about privilege, how I feel about privilege, particularly the kind of privilege that's institutional, that one that sort of frames one's destiny before one even comes on the scene, which I'm thinking about, you know, our United States of America in particular, but what's going on here in the United States of America is impacting Western culture and other cultures as well. And there's this whole thing around a few being, you know, sort of impacting the whole, and this whole thing around white skin privilege, even if one doesn't participate in it, it still exists. So I think to be aware of it is a way to undo it. And the whole thing about reparations, you know, sort of repairing the damage, I think that's something that we have to consciously participate in. We have to consciously be the one to ask the question when things are uncomfortable and to not let things just pass by, because it's just easier that way, because if one is privileged, you don't have to question the privilege because it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And my students, similar to what you were saying, Joanna, when you were talking to your young people, they're saying, well, you know, hey, we're children of the new millennium, and what you were dealing with when you were coming up doesn't exist for us. And that's my students. They're all 19, 20, 21, and they were reading Tim Wise. I'm like, well, that might have been for him, but we are not experiencing this.
Mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
doesn't exist. And so the whole American dream of you work hard and you'll do well, people just think, well, I'm not successful because I'm not working hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. You can work and work and work, and mm-hmm. it might not ever happen for you because of this invisible paradigm that is going unacknowledged. I mean, so anyway, that's what I feel about it. I think that we need to keep, so I'm really happy about The Monkey and the Devil. I like things like this, and all of your work, Joanna, is like that. You always make us uncomfortable.
Sorry.
And your work always makes us question those things that we don't want to question. And, well, shoot, I mean, that was South Africa. They had their Truth and Reconciliation, but, you know, here in America, we're, like, really beyond that. And then we have the anniversary of the end of, you know, the importation of African people, and then we have the 200th anniversary in January of the largest slave revolt in the history of this country in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it just passes by, and nobody says anything. And then we have the UN or UNESCO saying that this is a year of, I'm trying to think of, sort of looking at the transatlantic slave trade, and here we are in April and nothing's happening with regards to programming, you know, or educational this, except for, you know, you're doing something, Joanna, with The Monkey and the Devil. But people don't know about these things because they don't get raised because they're uncomfortable. I mean, when you did that last piece down Market Street, you know,
mm-hmm.
the African-American people, you know, citizens of the county and city of San Francisco leaving town. I mean, like getting on ships and sailing away. It's like, what? Who knows that history?
Yeah, I know. That's an extraordinary invisible history here in San Francisco. These amazing people,
mm-hmm.
highly educated, brilliant thinkers, artists, getting up and leaving because you know, it wasn't the land of the free. You know, it was.
Well, that particular interview went a little bit longer than I thought, so we weren't able to get to the rebroadcast of the piece on Marilyn Buck. So we'll have to do that some other time because we are joined in the studio by Napoleon
Hello.
And Val Sarant. Good morning.
Good
How
morning.
Are you?
Yeah. Good morning. Yes,
good
Napoleon,
morning.
You're
morning.
On.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Val.
Yeah, and Wanda, thank you so much, you know, for your support as usual.
Oh, and thank you, Val, for letting me know about this great show tonight at Ashkenaz Music and Dance Center in Berkeley, the African Showboys. You know, Ghana's going to be in the house, my goodness.
Yeah,
I was looking at your website, Napoleon, and I really like what I read on your website. You know, your ensemble is a tribal ensemble, and all of you all are brothers. You combine drumming and dance and magic and adrenaline and a spectacular performance that has taken you around the world. And there's five Sabah brothers. Yourself,
yeah,
Joseph, Isaac, Moses, and JJ, and you grew up in a tiny village, Benaba. In the southeastern part of Ghana without electricity or schools. That sounds really interesting. And talk to us about this drumming tradition that you have and as well as the dream that you had to share this work with the community. And then, Val, I want you to talk about your wonderful work. You know, you're from Trinidad and Tobago, and you're like, when people think, you know, sort of steel pan and sort of real, you know, sort of, I don't know, African-centered musician, you know, you come to mind because you are everywhere. I mean, we see you with Mother Play, we see you with your own group, we see you with, you know, the group, you know, the young people that you've inspired, and you, what's the name of the group that you you have with the girls?
Sisters with Style.
Yes, Sisters with Style. How old is that ensemble? They've grown up. How old is that group?
Yeah, they're big ladies now. They're in Trinidad more than me. They go down there and they learn the, you know, different aspects of the culture. One of them just texted me to tell me she'll be in Brazil in 2 weeks or something like that. So they're really moving forward. And, you know, they have their own carnival bands and everything that they do. So I'm really proud of them, you know. So that's it.
Right.
But I would like Napoleon to tell you more about African showboys, because Baba Olatunji, I first met them when I went to Nigeria to record with Chikuru. You know, Chikuru Adepoju is our resident Grammy Award winner right here in Oakland,
that's
you know.
Right.
Yeah, so he also will be a special guest tonight. So.
Oh, really?
But let Napoleon tell you about African showboys.
All right, Napoleon, take it away.
Hello. The African showboys, we are five brothers from the northern part of Ghana. And we are brothers, one father, one mother. So my name is Napoleon. My backbone is Joseph, and his backbone is Isaac, and Isaac's backbone is JJ, and then JJ give to Francis. We from the northern part of Ghana, and my village before, the people is imagining that they said, before they said, what is African music? People saying that African music is something different, and it's like the tones, bing, boom, is the same. And I don't believe it, because Africa too have something. So I'm giving this word that they should come tonight and hear what we call African music. Because tonight will be African, real African music with different tone and different sound. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about your relationship with Babatunde Olatunji, the father of world music.
Babatunde Olatunji, there was a man called Diabet Fahi. He was working in Radio Cancan, and then we were in Ivory Coast. Then we heard that there is a man looking for us, and we don't know what we did because we were kids. That time I was like 16 years, so. Like, the man is looking for us. What do we do? So we were even hiding, knowing that it's a good thing. And the man was looking for us everywhere. He heard our music in Radio Cancan. So he was looking for us, and then he came to Ghana, get us, and then now trying to bring us to U.S. We even traveling to France, and Baba said, don't go to France. I don't want you to go to France anywhere. Baba keep on feeding us. We play. We even have a song of Baba. Two songs of Baba, Welcome to Ghana, and then we have a song too of Baba's story, like how he died, and he, Baba is too much. He's taking care of us since long time. He works here, he makes the money, he sends to us to eat. That is how Baba do. Baba is so good with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when another name suggests to Baba is his father, you know. So,
and
you know, I first met him too in Trinidad and Tobago as a young person. He came and performed there, and it was really very instructive. And he just loved Trinidad and Tobago because, you know, we retained a lot of the Yoruba tradition in Trinidad and Tobago. But even with the demonstration he did in Trinidad too, he showed how the trap drum set evolved from African drums and percussion, you know. So that's the depth of what it is with Baba too, you know, that I really love. And we shared a lot because I played with him too here, as well as Sikiru Adepoju, who I said will be tonight also playing. You know, he's the, well, they say talking drum here, well, from the Dundun family, which has been in his family for centuries. He has won a Grammy Award with Mickey Hart and the Grateful Dead, and so, and Baba was on the original Planet Drum, you know, which was really a fantastic thing, because many people just look at drumming as being in the so-called background with recorded music, but the drum is really language and everything that is involved traditionally. So it's really instructive, and tonight, as Napoleon said, people will be getting the real thing. And I will be just there to tie in the connections, because my great-uncle, who was sent to Nigeria from Trinidad in the late 1920s to help and work with the development of the railroads there, he was a very good friend also of Kwame Nkrumah. You know, they were close friends. And he helped to work towards the independence of Ghana. That's my great uncle, James Winthrop.
Oh, wow.
Wow. And also, like, even with Kaiso music, well, Kaiso, or what people call in Calypso, many people hear Harry Belafonte and so, mm-hmm. but Kaiso comes from the Yoruba words, Ko-Aiso, which means to bring the world together, you know. And Ooh. Kaiso is very important, and even Lord Kitchener, well, they took these names, you know, the Kaisonians in Trinidad. You have the Mighty Sparrow, Lord Invader, and you know all these names. But mm-hmm. Kitchener, who is now an ancestor, one of our foremost Kaisonians, he also was in Europe during that time mm-hmm. for the independence of Ghana. And he composed the Calypso, which is regarded as the unofficial anthem of Ghana, you know. Mm-hmm. So that the connection has been very deep. There, you know, so in that case, so he records with the independence of Ghana for the March 6, 1957, and so, you know. So
yeah.
there's always been that connection, you know, with our people. People try to make it as though Africans don't like people in the Caribbean or here and vice versa, but it's not true. The link has always been there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, Ghana was the first nation to get its independence, from the colonial rulers, you know, Britain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Kwame Nkrumah, you know, is known as, you know, really being, you know, one of the premier fathers of Pan-African consciousness. Because
he
opened the country to everyone to come.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Let me interrupt you and show you a deeper connection with Trinidad and Tobago and the Caribbean. And, you know, with Marcus Garvey. And
yeah,
I had the privilege because I worked on the port in my country in the 70s. And the last ship from the Black Star Line
mm-hmm.
came to Trinidad and Tobago. So
really?
So I was on board that ship with the captain, you know, and the crew members.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was speaking with some of the younger crew members, you know, we were there. And when I asked about Kwame Nkrumah, they started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said that Kwame Nkrumah was about the unification of all African people.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that a number of our own people, you know, weren't aware of that. I mean, they were in tears, literally. And what happened, too, is that with that Black Star Liner, you know, we're connected with the whole Marcus Garvey movement.
Wow.
Because Marcus Garvey was about having your own ships and everything else, you know. Doing your own trade and so on. So it was very profound. But another deep connection, I'll show you now. C.L.R. James from Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
He wrote
The Irritated Genie, huh?
Right. And also The Black Jacobins.
Yeah.
A very important book, you know, dealing with Haiti and the revolution and so on. C.L.R. James is the one who introduced Marcus Garvey to George Padmore, another Trinidadian, because as Dr. John Henry Clark says, a lot people don't know that a lot of the early, what we call in Pan-Africanists, came out of Trinidad and Tobago. Mm-hmm. So C.L.R. James wrote a letter for Kwame Nkrumah to take to George Padmore, and in it he wrote, George, I have a young man here. He's not too bright, but he's intent on kicking the Europeans out of Africa, you know. But that was the kind of introduction that Kwame Nkrumah was given because of the oppression that was going on with all of the people, and they were looking to liberate Ghana. So that you had that unification of Pan-Africanists to really help for the liberation of Africa. So that's how my connection is there in this whole story.
Wow, yeah. And then now, you know, sort of the push in Africa is the United States of Africa. And that was what President...
Kwame Nkrumah.
No, more recently, President of Libya, who was executed, Gaddafi. Yeah, he was pushing that. And I think that was one of the main reasons why he was killed, was because he was pushing for, you know, African self-determination, and
mm-hmm.
and he was really well known for supporting, you know, the African diaspora, mm-hmm. not just on the continent, but
mm-hmm.
throughout the diaspora. You see investments, and he'd send money,
mm-hmm.
you know, to various countries, you know, within the Pan-African diaspora and America and other Western nations don't like that.
But, you know, this is why I like, you know, Napoleon and they have one of the songs in which they're saying that, you know, no more war, you know, it's really too ridiculous all over the planet. It's time for people to wake up and know that we really want family on this planet, you know? So, well, maybe Napoleon can tell you about some of the traditional instruments and so, too, you know?
Because I was reading Napoleon that, you know, you mentioned that you were born from the same mother and father, but collectively there are 54 children from your father's descent, and you're the eldest, and you received a vision from your grandfather named Apabum.
Apabum Abuguri.
Yeah, during a juju practice. I was wondering if you could talk about this vision and your journey. You were supposed to embark on a world journey in an effort to bring recognition to the suffrage of the African people and feed your ever-growing family. And that's when you, you know, you engage your brothers and you all have been on this journey. I wonder if you could talk about that as well as, you know, sort of the instrumentation of your band.
Okay. The time we started our music in my village, Binaba, my grandfather, Amum Abugri, wanted me to take care of his horse. He don't want me to go to school. And so I was too close with Amum Abugri. He is my grandfather. And my father was a soldier, which is Joe Saba. And he don't want me to go to take care of the cows. He want me to go to school. So the thing that what happened was I want to play my music. So when I start playing my kone, the two strings of guitar called kone, when I start playing it, and then my grandfather like it, he want me to play in the house. He don't want me to go anywhere. So I travel to Bolga, Boku. My father too have a lot of children, and everybody is well educated, going to school, and I don't want to go. So I start taking my brothers one by one, joining me, and we travel to the neighboring village in Ghana, Bolga, Boku, Tamale, Takoradi, Accra, playing music, making money, and bringing back home and taking care of some of the children. So later on, we start making it like a West African tour. We traveled to Togo, Benin, Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, Algeria, Libya, Burkina Faso, and Senegal. We traveled all those places. When we go 1 year, we come back. We go three months, we come back. That is how we'll be feeling ourselves. But our instruments that we play is, my own is kone, two strings guitar, made with gourd, with a python skin on it, and then we have binbil and bintitat, what is called a response drum. It's a gourd with a rope tied on it, and then the antelope skin with a binbil bintitat sesan, and then the music that the dancing that we dance to, we call it alakumpola kuk, and then company warap. That is the type of dance to we dance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sent an email to you. I know it to them. If you see the height they are up in the air, you know,
Yeah. I was wondering, Napoleon, if you could talk a bit about your names. You've got these aren't African names, and I was just wondering if you could talk about your names and your traditional culture, and I was just wondering, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Like our names?
You know, because, you know, we see the stamp of colonial presence in your country, you know, in your names. And also in some of the traditions, like, you know, some of the religious traditions like Christianity versus the indigenous religions that were there prior to, you know, the British presence and other colonial presences within the continent of Africa. And I was just wondering if you could talk about sort of identity and how one maintains one's heritage in the face of an invasion, because, you know, your country, Ghana, was invaded, you know, by the British, you know, for all those hundreds of years. And yet, you know, you still speak your language, you know, you still have traditions, but then you're carrying these names, which don't necessarily, I mean, you know, probably, you know, as a form of commerce, a lot of times people had to take on these names in order to go to school, in order to be recognized, in order to be seen. But, you know, but then you knew that you weren't necessarily Napoleon. You were somebody else. But this was sort of like a pass so you could get through the system, so to speak. I'm sure you could talk a little bit about being a conscious person, you know, in an occupied kind of setting.
The English is too big for me. You understand? In my village, we like this. We didn't go to school, so the English is too big. So I can set it one by one. But if you don't understand, you can ask me again.
Okay.
My real name is Azankwat, not Napoleon, but Azankwat is my traditional name, but my father gave me Napoleon because my father was a soldier. And Isaac is Asul, and Joseph is Baju, and Francis is Asulwin, JJ is Akeyut, and then Moses is Agbango. So they use the chief use his forefathers' names and give it to us. But me, my grandfather was so loved to me, so he gave me Asul in the house, Azankwat in the house, so that I will use Azankwat for we use skin like animal skin to seek. If you are a king, you have to we kill lion, tiger, antelope to skin. That is what the chief said. So we use those names, those skin names to name all we the family in the house. That is the names that we have in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because like even the Caribbean, like for with myself too and other people, it was really forced upon a lot of the people that you have to take a so-called Christian name, you know? So that is how it is. Because like for me, to even other traditional ways that people call like Uncle Tunji or Elan and them from Nigeria, they call me Bale, you know? Which means like the chief of the village. So a lot of things. And then for Yogi Bhajan, who was one of my teachers, I had a vision of him before I even met him. He was what you call the Mahan Tantric or Master of White Tantric Yoga. And with him, from an ancient calculation that they did, it's not this newspaper astrology that people deal with, but that the name that for me, for the time that I was born and so, in that old language, is called Sat Hari, you know, which means like the true God. And a name is not just a name or to be pompous, but it means you have to live up to your name, you see, traditionally. So this is how it is. But a lot of things that happen with the enslavement and colonization of a lot of countries, that is what has happened, that even they forced people to not even want to do your own traditional music. In my country, there's one sister called Ella Handel. Well, she was born in Grenada, but she has been doing, like when she recorded a whole album with what we call the Oriki, or praise songs for the Orisha in the Yoruba tradition, people from the Catholic Church were protesting, because that's what it is, to make you ashamed of your language and culture. And you know, as Malcolm X has said, it has been put out for people to be ashamed of their hair, your nose, your lips, you know, that whole thing about having African people hate themselves and their culture. This is why I am really so proud of Napoleon and they for keeping the tradition. You know what I'm saying? Keeping that tradition. Because this is the problem with a lot of our children in the so-called diaspora, even here. For example, one school I worked at in San Lorenzo High School, one of the girls who was teaching there one day called and asked me to come to play for her class. She started doing dance. And she had studied with myself and Jackie Atman, who's from Trinidad too, one of our foremost dancers. So she knows some of our traditional dances. And when we went there, one day we taught her one dance for Yemoja, right, in the Yoruba tradition. Mm-hmm. And when you see them dance, one day I'm telling you, you could swear that they came from my village.
Mm-hmm.
And one day in that dance room, there's a phone with a speaker on it. I called Ella Handel from in Trinidad, and I surprised them. So because I taught them one of the sounds, you know, for Yemoja. And I put Ella on the speakerphone, and Ella sang that song for them. And spontaneously, all of the children screamed out in the room. To show you that, I mean, they may not have their finger on the pulse of what is missing, but when they get it, oh, it's all over. And
right.
That is what is happening, and like Napoleon, and that picture I just sent you on the email is with them at schools, you know. So you go to the school, same thing I try to do, to let the younger people know what's happening about their culture. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah, we keep it going, don't worry. Like I've worked in a lot of all the juvenile halls with Wajumbe organization. We coordinated a program in 4 state prisons, you know, taking
really?
A lot of the culture
okay.
there. So mm-hmm. So it's very important because when people, you know, have that, then they don't be frustrated. Look, I'm right opposite Castlemont High School, and they recently closed down the art school there. Where Sister Tarika Lewis, you know, she
yeah.
was doing such a phenomenal job there. And that whole thing is gone. About 10 schools that I worked at, they've either cut the programs or they closed the schools entirely. So this is why we're trying in all our ways to get the cultural traditions to the younger people, you know, so they don't go astray.
Oh, you sent me some music. Oh, darn. I'll have to play it at the end of the show.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah.
that. Okay.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, Napoleon, if you could maybe talk about sort of what you're going to be doing tonight, and Val, how you're going to bring in your special guests, Val and Sikaru, what are they going to be doing? And I noticed that in a video that I saw that there was actually, you were doing some magic. Are you going to be eating fire tonight?
Tonight is going to be music.
Okay.
No fire. Tonight we're going to be music and dancing, and there will be more things to do, but there won't be fire because, you know, here fire is like in our village, the fire that we do is like when there is maybe a house burning, and you know, in our village we built all our house with clay and sand. So, and then the top, we roof our houses with straw.
Mm-hmm.
So, when fire catch a house, then we use that juju powers to go in the house and quench the fire. But here, like the houses that they have here, some clubs don't like you to do the fire. So, tonight won't be fire, but it will be we will have more things to do better than fire. So, yeah, better than fire.
Yeah, because
you have to get
permit and fire permit. Even what you know, Tommy Sion, who was from my country, when we would do the limbo, you know, you go under the fire too with the limbo. So he had to develop a thing where you had something you can push that bar in so it would out, you know, because many places, as you say, they don't want you to use the fire, and all of that is part of the tradition. Because the limbo dance is part of the funerary dances like the bongo and so, you know. So, yeah, it's really instructive. I was still hoping that maybe they can slip in one of the little things that they do where they pour the water in. Maybe that one we can try to see if we can get Isaac to do that one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that one.
Yeah,
that one.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be super.
But
yeah.
The music that we'll be playing tonight will be we'll be talking more about Kwame Nkrumah, and we're talking about the African and Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Because Africa and Americans, either you are a black or you are a white, we are all the same because it's the same blood. And we, the African showboys, want to mean the no more war, because it seems like people fighting here about I'm black, they took me, I'm a slave, and whatever. No more that. We should be one and then united. Yeah, that is what is going to happen tonight. And we're going to say more things about trouble. Trouble is a song, and that we don't want trouble. Yeah, and then we're going to talk, sing a song of Kwame Nkrumah, Marcus Garvey, the people who fight and keep Africa. Yeah, we will be singing more songs about that one too. And then we'll sing some Bob Marley songs too. Like Redemption Song. Yeah. With my two strings I play Redemption Song. It will be they will like it. So people should not sit in the house and listen only the radio, but they should come down there and listen tonight. They will see what is African music.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So you'll be at Ashkenaz Music and Dance Center tonight, which is located on San Pablo at Gilman in Berkeley, and the doors open at 8:30 and the show starts at 9. Is that correct?
Oh,
you're going to have a workshop at 8 o'clock?
Yeah, a brief, just as an introductory,
Nice.
And then from 9 o'clock we do the show. So,
okay, cool.
Myself and Dickie will be there. So, yeah, we add a little spice. I'll play a little steel drum for people, too. Because the steel drum, evolved from the African tradition, you know. Because the drums were banned in our country, we kept using the bamboos, that we call tambo bamboo. And then those were banned by the colonial people. Although in our villages we still kept it, but then we invented the steel pan or steel drum, regarded as the only true instrument invented in the 20th century. So from the garbage can, we create an instrument. So I'll play that today, especially for the children who we expect to come.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah. So.
Okay, cool, super.
So we're ready.
We're looking forward to seeing you this evening. It's going to be really lovely.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah. And thank you both, so much for joining us. So, Val, what music did you send me? I noticed some different songs.
This one is, it's something that they're working on, a recording that they're doing, and Sikiru is playing on it, too.
Africans and Americans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, all of them, you know. There's Trouble, all of them, they have, So it's in progress, so that's like a new album that's coming out, so you're getting a preview.
Okay, great. Well, audience have to look forward to that. Yeah, we'll play that a little bit later on in the show toward the end.
Okay, wonderful.
Super. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. It's been really great speaking to you, Napoleon, and it's always good speaking to you, Val, and looking forward to the show this evening with the African Showboys, Napoleon, you and your brothers, and your special guests, Sikiru and Val. It's been really excellent.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. You both take good care. Looking forward to seeing you this evening.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye-bye.
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 Let's see, Opal, is that you?
That's me.
are your lovely daughters going to be joining us as well?
One daughter is here and the other daughter is supposed to be calling in.
Okay, great, super. So I was actually on Shola's website. Which daughter is calling in, Teju or Shola?
I'm here. This is Shola.
Oh, Shola. Oh, welcome back home from Paris.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I guess we'll start with Mom's bio. Opal Palmer-Adisa is a writer, photographer, and full professor at California College of the Arts, teaching in the MFA program and undergraduate writing and literature programs. A writer in all genres, she has 14 books to her credit. My goodness, Opal, that's impressive. 14 books, wow. And your works have been anthologized in over 400 journals, magazines, and periodicals worldwide. Your latest novel, which you're going to share some of, Painting Away Regrets. How lovely an image, Painting Away Regrets. Just go pull up your easel and get some colors and paint away your regrets. Wow, that's nice. You're going to share that from that. And you're also going to talk about the groundbreaking anthology you co-edited, Caribbean Erotica.
Yeah.
Ooh. Wow. And then Teju is an expressive Jamaican-American student who will graduate from Wesleyan University in the spring of next year. You identify as a citizen of the world, and you enjoy traveling, connecting with people, and learning about different cultures. You're worldly and intellectually curious, and you use your passion for education to learn about the socio-political conditions of your world and simultaneously discover and learn more about yourself in the process. Your main areas of study are sociology and political, critical, culture, and social theory. But social justice and global awareness are two of your main passions. You believe that education allows you to gain an understanding of the world as it relates to your ideas of personal growth, creativity, happiness, and ultimately sustainability. Teju, you have a love for dance and poetry and writing and music and research, and you continually think of new projects that you can take to all corners of the world. And you're going to be sharing some of your work as well. This is going to be just a wonderful. Oh, I think that might be your sister. Shayla, is that you?
No, Shayla's here. Teju is calling in.
Oh, Teju. Oh, okay. Sorry. Teju, how are you?
I'm good.
You probably heard me reading your bio. And now, Shola, got mixed up here. You are a trained singer and actress, and you studied at Fordham University, where you earned a Bachelor's of Arts degree in music, the American Conservatory Theater, Black Repertory Theater of Berkeley, and with master teachers Jacqueline Schneider, Philip George, Carolyn Thomas, and Tony nominee Emily Skinner, to name a few. After surviving several episodes as one of Damon Dash's candidates for BET's business competition-based reality show, Ultimate Hustler, 2005, Shola has made appearances on such leading TV and radio shows as BET's 106 or 106 and Park, KMEL's 106, Chuy Gomez's radio show in Northern California, and WWPR, Power 105 Star, and Buck Wild's syndicated morning show. And AFTRA, A-F-T-R-A member, you have to tell us what that means, Shola's entertainment portfolio stretches the gambit from independent film, television, voiceovers, dance, and vocal performance. And she has established residence in both New York City and Paris, where you now spend most of your time and perform regularly there, and you lead a Black African-centered Paris tour that you're going to tell us about, aren't you?
Oh, yes, I've seen about that as well, sure.
Yeah, yeah. So, where do we start? Oh, my goodness. We'll start with Mama. So, Opo, how do you bear such wonderful, creative children? And, you know, we haven't even talked about your son. So, yeah, how do you do this? Just one woman with all these stars. Oh, my goodness. You have your own constellation in your house.
Well, I think it's just modeling. I think, you know, I have just been doing my work, and I've always said to my children that my work is important to me, and they've always respected it. Mm-hmm. And I've always taken them to wherever I'm going. You know, I've always taken them to my various presentations and to other people's presentations. So I think the fact that they have stepped into their own skin as artists, as activists, as educators are simply part of the modeling that they've seen from me and the wonderful cadre of friends that I've been fortunate and blessed with to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Teju, the younger of the two daughters on the air right now, how is it, how do you maintain your own, sense of self in the midst of such brilliance?
Well, I'm really good at multitasking because of my mother. So that's something that we've learned to do throughout our childhood and into young adulthood. So whatever I'm passionate about, I make sure I have time to do that and still study and still work and do all the things that I need to do in addition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how's it going at Wesleyan?
Oh, great. It's my last year, and I was gone all last year in Ireland. So it's nice to be back with friends. Mm-hmm. It's difficult because it's my senior year, and there's lots to do. Excuse me, but I'm really enjoying it, but I'm glad it's kind of still closed. Like, it's just starting a new chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Tell us about Ireland. You were in Ireland for a year, study abroad, I presume?
Yes, I was in Ireland for a year doing research on their traveler community, which is a disenfranchised community native to Ireland. I had a great time. It was lovely. The Irish are similar to Jamaicans, so they're very welcoming and happy, and they like music, and they like to dance. So I adjusted very well, and I didn't want to leave. It was a great time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one thing's about the people indigenous to Ireland, you know, the Gaelic and the whole colonial oppressive type of history that they have, you know, looking at Britain and the English. I was wondering, you know, there's some similarities in looking at sort of Western dominance that is indicative of our communities in the Pan-African diaspora. I was wondering if, and there are a lot of people of African descent, I think there are a lot of Africans in Ireland as well, right?
Yes. There are a lot of Nigerians, and Ireland, besides being an island, has a history very similar to Jamaica or Ghana or other British colonies, and they also struggled for their independence in 1922 from the British Empire. So they do have that similar post-colonial industry as well as mentality, and I think that's what makes them so similar to other, you know, third world nation peoples.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. So did some writing come out of that experience? What academic project did you have that you had to complete with your study abroad there?
It was mostly just research for my thesis, my honors that I'm doing this year. So there's lots of different types of writing, a lot of doing volunteering and just reading a lot. And so this year is when all of that will culminate into a pretty long essay that I'll have to defend in the spring.
Okay, okay. Yeah, does it have a title? Can you share that with us?
I'm not exactly sure what the title is going to be definitive. But there's this concept called the fourth world, which is to describe people native to a land, but they're excluded from the land's resources and territories and social and political aspects. So that's a lot of people living in the first world in somewhat third world conditions. So I think the title is going to be The Fourth World, Limits to Nationalism and Identity with the Traveler Nation in Ireland.
Oh, wow. Looking forward to that. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. And Shola.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to us. I was listening to your piece. Your website is just really lovely. I was looking at Just You, Suspicious, listening to Just You, Suspicious, and visiting ShaulaJoy.wix.com. Really wonderful website. And you are so beautiful. Oh, my goodness. I mean,
thank
you know, Teju, you're beautiful, too. But I hadn't seen Shola in a while. Yeah, so Shola, tell us about Afra and what you've been up to in New York, and that's a big question.
Okay.
and Paris. Maybe you can start with the Parisian tour, but tell us, you know, sort of what that you said that in the bio I was reading that you are a member of AFTRA. What
does
that mean?
Very quickly, AFTRA is the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. And it's also like SAG, which is the Union for Screen Actors Guild Union. So those are just professional acting organizations that you're part of when you do professional work. So since I was 10, I was doing voiceovers for radio and television shows and things like that. So that's just one of the organizations that I'm affiliated with that supports me as a professional actor.
Okay.
So that's what AFTRA is. I've been a member for a really long time. And then the song is what I'm really excited to share. It's called Just You, Suspicious. As you said, you listen to it. It's on my website, www.sholajoy.com. And there's also a YouTube video for it now. And it's just talking about, basically, it's inspired by the incident, the Trayvon Martin incident. I was living in Paris when it happened. And there was no news about it in Paris, but I plug into a lot of U.S. news and politics. And so it was something that I was really affected by because it seemed like this situation kept happening over and over again. And there was, you know, I wanted to say something about it. So the song is is my, I guess, dedication to black men and black boys and to all of us dealing with, you know, being perpetually hit by this scenario that keeps happening and maybe being more aware of what's happening and then taking a stand about it. So the song is about that, and I did it with a French producer, actually, and it's something that I'm very proud of and something that kind of links with the tours, because you asked to talk about the tours. I'm also a tour guide with Walking in the Spirit Tours.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tour that basically takes tours, mostly American or English-speaking tours for sure, around the historical landmarks that African-Americans traversed in Paris. So, but and normally between World War I and World War II, or after World War II, so we're talking about, of course, Josephine Baker, James Baldwin, Richard Rye, Chester Himes, so a lot of the intellectuals and also the jazz musicians and the singers who were present at that time. And so one of the things that has echoed a lot in when I give these tours is that African-Americans, outside of their landscape, outside of being home, being a foreign country, have the opportunity to digest their presence and their effects easier being outside of it. And so one of the reasons why I'm bringing that up is because also this song, I don't know if I would be able to write this song if I was here, because maybe I'd be really inside of the scenario, you know, inside of the situation and very riled up. But outside of the environment, I'm able to look at it from a distance and create something from that place. So that's something I think my life now in Paris is mimicking and continuing the legacy of all these other black Americans who came there before me and started to have a freedom to express themselves in ways that they didn't feel that they had the ability to do when they were at home. And definitely not the opportunities that they had at home, they have living abroad now in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And actually, I'm going to play the song because I uploaded it before our conversation. But you have a lot of images that are I guess it's a part of the, I guess the, you know, as the of the film, yeah, as people watch it. If you could talk about some of the imagery that you have connected to the song.
Okay. Because
people aren't going to be able to see it as they listen.
Yeah, they won't be able to see it, but they can if they go to my site, showofjoy.com, from there there's a YouTube link, and it's the first video that's on the YouTube link on my homepage, so you'll be able to see it. It's just mimicking the words that I say. When you listen to the song there, I bring back a lot of historical references, like I say, blood on the trees, and so that's obviously referring back to lynchings, and so there's some images of that, or I also make a reference to Emmett Till, and so there's an image of him there also, because he's another black man who was, you know, harshly punished for something that we're not sure whether or not he did. So just that, these situations like Trayvon Martin obviously are not new, and they keep getting repeated in history, and as much freedoms as we have as African Americans and as many opportunities that we feel that we have, and obviously with Barack Obama being the president, there's still a root issue happening here, that black men are continuing to be targeted, and no matter what they do, they're being labeled as suspicious. And so that's a real problem for me, because obviously my father is black and my brother is black, and so I just think, you know, what if that was my brother, you know, and my brother's a good kid he's an adult, but doing well, teaching other students how to play soccer and do all these things, but he wears a hoodie a lot because he's cold or whatever. And that, I mean, how would that make me feel? And so also the song later, first I just kind of, the beginning of the song talks about how the scene went down, as far as I know it, from Trayvon Martin, like what kind of happened and the atmosphere in the air. And then towards the end, then the middle of the bridge talks about the history, and that's when we see the lynchings, if you were to watch the video. And then at the very end, I switched to the voice of a mother, how a mother feels raising a black boy. I'm not a mother yet, but what I would imagine, because I feel like in many ways I've mothered my brother, how I would imagine it would be raising a black boy to not be scared of his life, but also to be very aware, but also wanting him to feel as though he can take advantage of the opportunities that are available to him. So this kind of slippery slope that I think mothers of black sons have to manage, how they can raise confident men to be living here in America and be successful and to be safe. The fact that people in 2012, black men in 2012, have to really worry about their safety is something that's outrageous. And so that's also where the song goes in the end. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm going to play it now.
Okay.
And breaking news tonight, the tragic shooting of an unarmed teen in Florida. Now 28-year-old Zimmerman called police when he saw 17-year-old Trayvon Martin and thought that he looked suspicious.
Goes off to Uganda
because she had also met this man in law school, and in between the divorce, before the divorce, they kind of reunite. Anyway, I'm reading the section just after Christine and Donald hooked up in Berkeley, and she goes to his place for the first time. They entered the apartment, arms entwined. He disengaged from her and walked into the darkness. She stood by the door waiting for him to turn on the light. What was taking him so long? He seemed to be in another part of the apartment. Weird or what? She didn't like being in the dark in an unfamiliar place. Donald, are you going to turn on the light? Sorry, he replied, switching on the light in the kitchen. Usually when I come in, I don't turn on the light in the living room. Well, you know your place, but I don't, she said a little bit more snappily than she had intended. I guess I'm a little nervous and excited, too. Christine looked him up and down. Delicate was the word that came to mind. She wasn't sure she had the patience to deal with his tentativeness. Well, this is my place, he said, sounding apologetic. Do you like it, Donald? Christine stared at him intently. Yes, I'm comfortable here, he said softly but with conviction. Then why are you apologizing? He looked pain. His hands rose to his waist and his fingers opened and closed. Christine scanned the apartment while she waited for its response. She hoped his lovemaking was as slow and reflective and detailed. Definitely minimalistic, she declared, walking around the living room. It had a futon sofa, a side table, and four bookcases stacked with books and papers. There was a single picture on the wall, a pencil drawing of Frederick Douglass. The apartment was clean, but it looked like an office. She couldn't live for very long in a space like that. Even your office had to have more comfort and intimacy. Plants, a rug on the floor, art on the walls to make it her own. Donald watched as she walked around, glancing at the tiles, the titles of his books. We share several of the same titles, she declared, brushing past him to go into the compact kitchen. I like a man who's clean. I'm impressed. No dirty dishes in the sink. Do you cook too? Yes, I was assigned to cook at home from the age of 9. Good, I'll take you. She noticed that his dining table was covered with books and folders of paper. I guess you don't entertain much. Well, I don't really have many friends or time. Oh, Christine was quite surprised by this admission. Was he worth her time? He was so serious, so stiff, although there were moments when he seemed relaxed and to go with the flow. But Christine suspected he wasn't quite fling material. On the other hand, if he was an adequate lover, she could keep him for the fall, someone to sleep with two nights of the week, but not to hang out or party with. He seemed decent, solid, but Trevor was probably right. Can you make me some tea, or would you prefer juice? Neither, she said. So this part just goes into the exchange between them. And part of the premise of this novel, I had interviewed 20 women, most of whom were in the academy, in the college or university setting, because that was my group, who had also gotten married and divorced to write this book. And one of the things that they all said is that from the very beginning, they knew that this person wasn't necessarily right for them, but they kind of overlook it. You know, you meet someone and you overlook their faults, or you think love is going to be the key that's going to make everything happen. But generally we know, and so the novel is exploring that. So this scene that I read, Christine kind of knows, you know, he's a fling, have a fling with him, but he's nice, and so it goes it goes a step further.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, you know, that saying, I believe, Tina Turner's song, you know, love is not enough, or when love is not enough, or something like that. And I'm like, Well, why not? I thought love was enough.
Yeah, I mean, we all think, thought so, or want to think so, but it really isn't enough. It really is, you know, and I think older people had a much more realistic thing when they were doing matchmaking. It wasn't about love. It was about compatibility. It was about what people want and who they were and the directions they were going. And I think in this modern world, we tend to romanticize it and think, oh, we're in love, and it's going to make everything right. It does not. In the end, it's like, are we on the same path? Do we enjoy the same things? Because the love might wear off.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
But I wanted to,
mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
I wanted to say another important thing about this book. In this novel is also arranged with the Orishas. So that each chapter, yeah, because, you know, part of my premise is that Donald and Christine's fates are really just fated by the Orishas.
Hmm.
And so the scene in here where Christine went to a Bembe, and that's how she and Donald actually start being lovers. And each chapter, the first section begins with one of the Orishas, Ilegba, because he opens everything. And each subsequent episode, they're not really chapters, each subsequent episode, you know, it opens and ends with the voice of one of the Orishas, because I wanted also to integrate that spiritual element in the book. You know, those people who are familiar with the Yoruba tradition, then they'll get it. Those people who are not, they might or they might not, but they will still see this kind of framing that happens throughout the novel.
Mm-hmm. Wow, interesting. Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, that when I was reading your bio, which is extremely modest, that this is like your 40th book, right? And you've been in
my
hundreds.
15, no, 14. 14.
14.
I mean,
oh, I'm,
yeah.
Yeah,
my 14th.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not 40.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm hoping to get there. I'm hoping to get to 40, but right now I'm 14. I mean,
okay.
my work has been anthologized a lot in over 400, probably much more now, journals.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I was just wondering, you know, with this novel, and you're talking about the Orishas, so looking at sort of the through line that spirituality has in, you know, in our culture. I was wondering if you could maybe for those that are not familiar with your work, and shame on them, but now they're going to be familiar with your work, if you could sort of put this book in the context of the type of books, like you've got novels, you've written writing manuals, you have collections of poetry. You know, you've written in your travels, you know, you're a woman that travels the world just like your children, you know, who are following after you. And some of your books are composed here and some are written elsewhere. And then you come to, you know, to us, you know, as an artist from, you know, having a really rich cultural experience that is not, you know, United States American. You know, you're from Jamaica, which is an entirely different place. So I wonder if you could sort of, that's a whole lot of questions in one, but, you know, you could take them one at a time.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that separate me from a lot of writers, I mean, and I think there are a number of writers who mix genre, but I'm a writer who is very comfortable and proficient in a novel. This is my second novel, but I have another two that I'm working on that I hope to finish by next year. I write poetry, so I have several books of poetry. I write short stories, and I have several books. In fact, my very first publication in 85 was a collection of short stories. And then, as you see, I write travel novels. I write articles on parenting and all of those things that have been published. So one of the things that I think demarks me from other writers is that I write very proficiently in the academic arena in terms of scholarly essays, and then in the creative arena in terms of poetry and prose and plays. I wrote a play last year when I was in St. Croix that was produced, they're hoping that I'll do a radio show there, like a radio drama series there that I'm working on. So that's just, you know, one aspect of who I am. And my work is very much rooted in my Jamaican African culture. While I'm from Jamaica and that has shaped me, I consider myself a citizen of the world, and I'm very much concerned with African or the African presence in the new world and how we are portrayed and how I portray us, and making sure that there's some cultural retention and transference, which is why for me, even though an initial publisher in the U.S. was interested in this book and they wanted me to take out the Orisha section and just make it the standard narrative, I always go to England because they appreciate my work and allow me to do what I wanted to do, because for me it's important that I share with people who might not be familiar that, you know, when we came over here as enslaved people, we brought our culture with us, and it has morphed and changed. But the Yoruba culture came in Jamaica, it's part of the Pacamania. In Brazil, it's Macunda. Macumba, Macumble in Trinidad, it's Shango. In the African-American South, it's Santeria, like in Cuba. So it's there. It has always been there. We haven't lost it. It has morphed and changed. And so my work very much is concerned with the African presence and how we have retained our culture
and that we are one people, whether we're from Jamaica or Kentucky or Alabama or New Orleans or Nigeria. And yes, there are very differences, but there's also a lot of commonality.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I wanted to know, we're going over a little bit, but that's okay, if maybe we could talk about sort of the mother-daughter connection and the sister-sister connection and the friendship connection that sort of resonates, you know, when anyone is in your company, you know, the three of you. I was wondering if you could talk about that, and perhaps maybe all of you could share a poem or something like that, or a song, Shola, if you want to. that's sort of, you know, is indicative of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know Teju will talk, share something from her book and talk about her book because she has a book that's out. But I just wanted to say that I really consider Shola and Teju, who are now young adults, my friend. Mm-hmm. And I think that friendship has come about because of the very wonderful and close relationship we had as mother-daughter and them traveling with me and us. Me being very honest with them, I think, on every foot. I don't know if they'll say something different. Mm-hmm. And certainly one of the things I encourage with all my three children, my son Jawara, and I think the three of them have this bond, and I always used to say to them is that, you know, we are a fist. And if you just take a little pinky finger or the middle finger, you could easily break it. But if you become a fist, then it's hard to, you know, splinter us. And so I see the four of us as this fifth as we go into the world. And one of the things I always said to Shola and Jawara and Teju is that they should always maintain and support each other no matter what as they grow up into adulthood. And I certainly think that they have that bond that exists between them. But I'll let them speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Teju?
Shola and I are very close, and we have traveled together. We talk almost constantly, I would say. And part of this, my mother has fostered a relationship between all of us where it is important to be close and connect. And since we all are in different corners of the world, it's important that we stay connected and up to date with what's going on and still support each other. So as a family, we are very close. We have a good time when we're together. We work through things together. So, you know, that's always been something that's been integral to our family. We ate together at the dinner table growing up. When we're coming together now, we eat together. We talk to each other consistently. So it's been a part of my experience being close with my family. And actually, in my book, I have a piece, a nonfiction piece. It's called The Fearless One, and it's inspired by Shola because at one point she had called me in college, and she had asked me about advice on something. And usually, growing up, I'd ask her advice, and now it's for equal footing. And she said, "Boy, Teju, you sure are fearless." And I remember thinking, I'm not fearless at all, but I do what I have to do in the face of fear. And so I have this piece that was inspired by her just simply saying that to me and taking my advice and understanding that we both had something to offer each other. So I don't know, you know, show what to say, but I definitely do think that we have all created a very close network of love and support and friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to share your piece, The Fearless One?
Yeah, sure. I can share a piece of it. It's kind of long. I was going to share a different poem, but this one, since you're talking about it, is fine as well.
Well, you could share some of that, and then you could share the poem that you had planned on sharing.
Yeah, I'll share a couple lines from this. She called me because I'm fearless. I'm not the fearless one. I am bold and over-encompassing in the face of those and things that try to consume us, oppression, suppression, religion, education, limitation. I'm infinite and entitled, infinite because I do not let little things end my spirit, entitled because I have the right to know my rights, exercise them when necessary, and understand that democracy is a word and not always action. She called me fearless. Not knowing how much that meant to me or we, I told her yes because I said yes to life and love and trust and forgiveness. We must journey because we are not progressing if we go nowhere. Progress is key to progression. A movement requires moving. Growth starts with learning. Education can be liberating or oppressing. I'm fearless because I stand bold in the face of uncertainty. I'm fearless because I trust my genuine inconsistencies. I'm fearless because I take on the name with integrity, not only because she called me. I made a choice shared decisions and became decisive when needed. It's not about the nose piercing or the tattoos or the boots or the short hair or the bracelets or the book. It's about the freedom to discover the truth and purpose within myself, because without these things, I would not be so fearless. And then at the end of that, it says, thank you, Shola. And so that, you know, it's a little longer. I just read a couple lines from that. But that was definitely something that was pivotal to our relationship, to understand that, yes, as she has inspired me so much and supports me so much and in a way is a second mother to me, I can also, as I've gotten older, support her and provide her with advice and my experience as well. And so kind of my book is in an anthology. It's a collection of poems, stories from childhood, and kind of different essays about social issues that I think are very important. It's a culmination of the three of those things, and it's called In Between Things. It's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, and Libris.com. And if you have a Kindle, you can get it on Amazon for $3.99. And it's called In Between Things because I think as growing up, doing a multitude of things, I'm always in between things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not achieving my goals or not elevating to the next level. So I think it's good to be in between things as long as you're still completing tasks, you're achieving your goals, and you're still striving for more. So in a way, it's not incompleteness. It's a point of completion, but always attaining for more. So it's just a combination of things. And going off the theme of just historical responsibilities and being Jamaican-American and also being very aware of the world, I wrote this poem. It's called Broken Lights, and it's talking about Caribbean people as well as people in African diaspora who speak in dialects and how that's invalidated and devalued because it was created by people who were enslaved, and by being enslaved, they were told they were unworthy and their whole body, their being was devalued. So this is kind of a poem talking about that. It's called Broken Lights. There are certain things you should read in the dark. Certain histories will drive you crazy, and insanity will only suffice in the dark. Your eyes will not only be strained, your mind will be drained, chained, and weary. His stories, imperial stories of conquering peoples whose dialects are a part of this world, this dialectic world of polarization, decrealization, yet we don't speak languages, only dialects. They say we speak brokenness. In this divided world full of broken thoughts, mostly selfish minds speak dialects. These histories, red and dark, do not speak to us. We speak because those histories push us to insanity, or they only exist because we spoke and in the darkness we rose. There are certain things you must hear in the dark. Certain words will bust your eardrums, and tantrums are best left in the dark. Our ears fail to respond to drums. Those were taken, yet we had tongues. We had feet, the feet that felt the earth that we came from. Busted eardrums, so heard the sound of homeland. And knowing that we were the chosen, we heard drums and we spoke dialects. We were marooned to the outskirts of our own island. Not languages, only dialects. We created nations, worked the land of indigenous decimation. That left silence, we were silent. We spoke in the history of Britain. We made movements, and historic colonization was created. We had revolutions, and yet we reduced to rebellion. We are those who spoke dialects. But if we did not, there would be no existence or acknowledgement. These stories that bleed insanity, and in the dark is where this will suffice, and in the dark is where we spoke, and in the dark is when we moved. Our feet that felt the earth, such a land of native decimation, and the silence that we found it. Running, the history was written. Freedom, the history was spoken. Nation, the truth was broken into lies. We only speak dialects because to call our creation language would imply that history is full of relentless fallacies. False down our reality, remind us where we belong in the dark. And when we read in the dark, our eyes are strained, our minds are drained, chained, and weary. Yet it is the darkness that we all emerged from. It is the darkness that we will return to. They call us the heart of darkness. Does that mean we are the beginning? Does that mean we are the ending? We're the people of the water, which is what destroyed the earth the first time. Next comes fire. Does this mean that we created language and only speak dialects? To appease history, to tease imperial fallacies, to admit the imposed reality, does this mean that we're the stories of the stories that were read to me when I only spoke love? Maybe we must read in the dark to remember when we only spoke trust. Maybe we must have tantrums in the dark so we can remember every time we were held. Maybe when I yell, your eardrums will bust, your feet will connect to the earth that silenced by genocide. Maybe it's time we spoke language, because dialect doesn't encompass all that makes us human, and maybe we are the heart of darkness. But that's only because the lights are broken, but we don't need them because we are people of the sun. So that was just, that was something that I wrote to seem very frustrated in the academic world that leave the Caribbean out so much in social sciences.
and in economics, and the government is just kind of clumped together and left out and ignored. So I wrote that poem in a frustration over that, as well as the idea that people in other nations don't speak language. They only speak dialects. They speak broken English or broken French or broken Spanish, and I don't think that's true at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really beautiful, sort of, you know, looking at the perspective from the lens of the one that's supposed to be less than, because, you know, the dominant culture, the Western culture that, you know, the invaders are framing it. And I really like that, the whole idea around, you know, one doesn't have a language, you know, but yet one does have a language. And then you're sort of the, you know, the heart of darkness, and then, you know, one thinks about, you know, Joseph Conrad, and but yet you don't mention him. So all of these sort of images that are in the, you know, collective consciousness, particularly the Western consciousness, that you are, like, you know, analyzing and then throwing back with a different interpretation, you know, more holistic ones. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I was definitely thinking of Joseph Conrad, because I know in most private or prep schools, you're supposed to read Joseph Conrad in high school, and I think that gives people a very distorted perception of the third world, or even calling it the third world, or calling it the developed world. So there are these ideas about the world outside of the West, and they're very distorted, and it kind of reinforces this inferiority complex, and that they aren't prospering, that they're on this whole other path, and that they're not contributing to the world. So I think it's important with my writing to always be conscious of that, and always to try my best to sell these myths. And part of why I study sociology and political theory is to do that in an academic way, in conjunction with my creative writing and my dance. So I think that's kind of, as a person, I'm coming from a holistic view as an activist and an artist and an academic.
Mm-hmm.
As with
right.
Cholet, Mommy, so that's a theme through our family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, Opal, Teju, and Shola, you know, that, you know, the whole idea of academic pursuit and excellence is a through line, you know, within your family, you know, father, mother, and siblings. Yet within that query, you're not losing yourself. A lot of times people lose themselves in Western, you know, academic arena because they're not really grounded in who they are. And I just think, you know, Opal, that, you know, within the way you raised your children, that they know who they are. So then when you put them in these settings where, you know, they could lose themselves completely, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I also think traveling is a big component of that. We've all made our own, I mean, we grew up traveling, and I think when you travel outside of the country, you have the opportunity to see how other people live, and the first time you might realize, wow, not everyone lives like me, even though I traveled to France before I moved there, and I've been to other countries before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in almost 2 years, I realized my thought pattern is really American. And although it seems obvious, yes, I was born in America and I was raised in America, but I didn't realize until I've lived there how vastly different just my thought pattern is, the way I approach things is based on where I'm from. So I think international travel is a really important part of our education, and we've taken that just as seriously as the traditional institutions education, because we know that also expands our minds to a wider perspective of what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And
certainly,
I think in addition, me and Mom identifying as citizens of the world is really important, because while we do understand our identity and our background and living in America and being Jamaican, we do understand and connect with other people in other countries and can understand their experiences and maybe have similar experiences. And I think also what we're really good at, which Shola might have alluded to, is adapting to cultures and understanding their difference and appreciating how we can use that to add to our identity and to increase our awareness as well as who we are. So while we're doing all these things and seeing all these things, we're not getting lost in them, I think, mainly because we're incorporating them into who we are. So Shola has incorporated French culture into her lifestyle. Now she's not as different as she may have been perceived when she first moved there a couple years ago. And likewise in Ireland, I adjusted very quickly because I could understand certain experiences and I could appreciate their culture and find a way to understand myself in it.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So you're saying that the self is not a static entity.
Exactly, exactly. It's fluid, and identity is fluid, and that's something, as a sociologist, that I think is one of the most important things to remember when studying society, because people are shaped by their society. So, you know, consequently, if you're going to other societies, they could shape you as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Yes, your travel is really important. It's really unfortunate that a lot of times economic situations limit one's ability to move outside of one's immediate environment to see that the world that you know intimately is not the only one there is. Because I think that go ahead.
Mm-hmm. As well as I think part of the unfortunate situation of you needing money to travel is that a lot of people who may feel isolated in where they are don't realize that there are other people around the world who may feel similarly to them, so they're alienated by being stuck in this one particular city, in this one particular state, in this one particular country. So one thing I want to do is try to find a way to connect people internationally to make them understand that you're not isolated, you're not alienated, and there are other people in the world who feel as you do and go through the same struggles as you do.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I think that will go a long way toward establishing a more authentic world peace.
Yes.
Yeah. Shola, do you want to share a poem?
Well,
thoughts on the topic?
Well, I would love to share this. There's another song on my website. I think that's the best way for you, you know, to be able to hear things clearly. The Just You song is also there. And then I did a reggae version of Fever. I don't know if you heard that, but a lot of people enjoy that. And so that's something that also could be found at www.sholajoy.com. So there you can hear all of my music and subscribe to me on YouTube or become my friend on Facebook and send me a word of encouragement being, you know, here from the Bay. Just getting the word out as I pursue my career in Paris and hopefully around the world.
And Shola is currently working on a documentary. I guess it's because it's in the beginning stage, she's a little reluctant to share it, but I think what I've been saying to her is that she needs to let people know that it's a project she's working on, because if she's looking for support, which she is, it's a way of getting support. So she'll tell you a little bit about that project. Well, it's just linking all of these things together that we've already spoke about, linking the African-American community in Paris and talking about the identities of being Black, because one of the things that I do the tours in Paris is that there's different groups of Black people in Paris. In France, and they're treated very differently. And again, coming from an African-American perspective, you know, my experience of race is very different than the way they deal with race in France. And so I became profoundly interested in these dynamics of a race, as subtle as they may be in France or not, and how these different groups, mainly African-Americans, people from sub-Saharan Africa, or Black Africa, as some people call it, like Senegal, Cameroon, and Ivory Coast, and then people from the Antilles Islands, like Guadeloupe, Martinique, and Reunion Islands, how these big groups of African Americans interact with each other and how they relate with the French culture and the French people. So that's part of what the documentary is exploring, and it's bringing together, as I said, this idea of music and the performing arts, and also my own interest in history and my work with history and doing the tours, and just exploring this idea of identity as well. So, all of that information. You could get in touch with me if you're interested in some of the, as you see, there's many things I'm doing. get in touch with me about that or what have you. All of that information is also on my site or will be available on my site. So,
And I
definitely want to encourage people. Last summer I was in Paris and I went on the tour with Shola. So for individuals or groups who are going to Paris and want to have that African American tour, they should definitely book Shola.
Book Shola, nice. I was wondering, Shola, one of your mother's colleagues at the California College of the Arts now, used to be CCAC, and his name is Raymond Saunders, wonderful painter, artist, and also visionary. And I was wondering, do you know Raymond Saunders, and how is your tour different or similar to his?
I didn't know that Raymond did a tour, does he?
Yeah, of Paris. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, I've met Raymond Saunders. I also wasn't aware that he did a tour. There's two other companies that I know of that do Black Paris tours, and I didn't know that he was one of those people, so I'm not really able to speak on the difference. I can just say what our tours offer. Yeah, so I don't know what he does. The tours that I do, mm-hmm. we have two walking tours. They're 2.5 hours, one on the left bank, which is the Saint-Germain-des-Prés area that normally deals with after World War II. The other tour is on the right bank in the Montmartre area, which deals with jazz in the 1920s. And then I do a bus tour that really does a combination of all of those areas, from when the first African-American that we know of, Sally Hemings, who was a slave to Thomas Jefferson, came to Paris, going all the way up to the 1960s. So that's what the bus tour covers. So those are the three different options that you can get with when you take a tour that we conduct with Walking the Spirit Tour.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's really great. I have the opportunity to meet some really wonderful people, travelers, and it's nice for me to be able to, as I said, to provide this information about a legacy that I would like to think that I'm continuing as I live there. And so that's mm-hmm. really been a, you know, a positive experience for me. And I collect more information about this place. When I first got there, I knew of Nina Simone and mm-hmm. Richard Wright and Josephine Baker, but besides that, I didn't realize the rich legacy of Black history, that's French history, that's there. And it's always nice when other African-Americans travel to Paris and they take the tours and they say, wow, you know, we have a real history here. It's not just Eiffel Tower, not just the Arc of Triomphe, but in all of that, there's African-American history. My ancestors had something to do with here, and that's something that's really rewarding.
Yeah, Julia Wright, Richard Wright's daughter, lives there. Do you know her?
I don't know her, but there's different conferences and things that she's been a part of, so mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to hear her speak. And Josephine Baker also has a son, a later adopted son,
mm-hmm.
who speaks a lot on her behalf and things like that. So.
Yeah. They did a film on Josephine Baker. It was a part of the, I think it was a part of Frameline, and her son came to San Francisco, and it was really great meeting him. Yeah, it's really wonderful that you're doing these tours because, you know, there's such a rich history there, and you're right, there are so many different Parises. James Baldwin
exactly.
writes about that in his Notes of a Native Son, you know, about how, you know, when he was an American, he was, you know, this type of African person. And then he goes to Paris and he's no longer, you know, the N-word. That's assigned to, you know, Algerians at that particular time. So
exactly.
it's, yeah.
I was just saying, yeah, it's a really interesting experience for me, too. Now my color is really irrelevant. American becomes first. And so that, for me, as I think a lot of African-Americans experience who've been there, frees up their opportunities because they're able to do other things because they're not considered a Black singer, a Black painter, a Black this, a Black that. They're a singer first, an artist first. And so that changes the way that you move in the world when you know people aren't looking at you as the ones of being Black first. You know, it frees up your creativity and the way you move. So I've experienced that freedom as well.
Right, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned already Josephine Baker, you know. Gosh, you know, she is such a heroine, you know. Her work, you know, during the war and as a spy, you know, as an agent, and in the awards that she received, and then all the children that she adopted and took care of. Gosh, she's really a phenomenal woman. Ah, thank you so much. And Opal, would you like to share a poem?
Here's what I will do. It's, you know, the section in the book that is opened by the Orisha voices, they're almost like a poem.
Nice.
Many of them are almost like a poem. So I will share this little piece, which is called Episode 2, and it's about Afe. Afe is the force that makes things happen. No one can avoid her. Her other name is patient, persistent. She regulates the day. In the old world, she appears as an ageless woman with a baby always asleep on her back. She is in motion, yet static. She is mystery. Everyone sees her and asks, how come? What if? She is the invisible force, but felt but not seen, experienced without being remembered. Although she is not dumb, she never speaks. She comes now disguised as an electric pole or a public statue.
She appears to be a hunchback or a bird perched on the wires. She represents both the past and the present, continuing forever widening. And that's it.
Nice. Thank you so much. Wow, it's been really wonderful having you on. Opal, thank you so much for the great idea.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to share the stage with my lovely daughters.
Yeah, lovely daughters they are, you know, Teju and Shola. Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, you know, all so much for joining us, you know, on this Thanksgiving weekend. And we certainly all have a lot to be thankful for. And thank you for sharing this time, you know, with your family, with us, to, you know, share your creativity and your vision for a better world. And we know that, you know, since you are the younger generation, that your hands are quite capable.
Yeah.
Yes,
thank you for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. You all take good care.
You too.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we're going to close the show with a couple of pieces from Val Sarant, who is a special guest this evening at Ashkenaz Music and Dance Center with the African Showboys, and we spoke to Napoleon a little bit earlier. And these are works in progress, so it's really cool that we're able to listen to them. The first one is called Africans and Americans, and then we're going to close with Azizan, gosh, I'm trying to pronounce it. Let's see. Azizandaniwa. Azizandaniwa. Anyway, Azidaniwa. All righty, you take good care, everyone. Looking forward to listening, having you tune in for another edition of Wanda's Picks on Wednesday morning. We are counting down to the end of this solar return, and this year, December 21st is the end of the Mayan calendar, end of an era. So it's a real special day for us to commemorate. And there are going to be some events happening in town and some events happening in Mexico. So we're going to have some guests on talking about that a little later on in this month and also in December. So here is Val Sarant, Africans and Americans, and I think Sikaru is also performing on this with him.
Yera kutaba, ya nomu tabie. Yeah.
Performance is this weekend, November 24th and 25th, at the Malanga Cascalore Center for the Arts Theater. That's 1428 Alice Street. And there are two thrilling pieces this year, The Leopard Ballet and Insight. And both of these bring together the vision and work of choreographers, dancers, and musicians from the Motherland, Diaspora, and East Bay together. And I'm speaking of Mama Naomi Duff and Dr. Zachariah Duff, both the choreographer and artistic directors of Diamanakora West African Dance Company, which has been around since 1975, for quite, many, many years. They're an institution, definitely. And again, this is this weekend. You don't want to miss it, November 24th and 25th. You can get tickets by calling, by calling area code 510-508-3444, 508-3444. You can email diamanoc at AOL.com, or you can visit their website, diamanakora.org. It's really wonderful, wonderful production. And this piece here, The Lion, The Leopard Ballet, it takes you on a journey through the forest where a female leopard has been ravishing a village, and the hunters called by the king to hunt her down. Diamanakora says that they'll be looking into the method by which African science is used to get at the truth. And that's that's taken, right from the founder, one of the founders of the company, Dr. Zachariah Duff's background in science. He's a scientist by training, as well as, a famous dancer, choreographer, and drummer from Senegal. See, Insight is a young man's journey to find himself in the knowledge that he exits because of his connection to every aspect of our common thread. And both of these pieces are having their home season debut this weekend, Saturday, November 24th at 8 o'clock, and Sunday, November 25th at 3 o'clock at the Malanga Cascalor Center for the Arts. And again, that's 1428 Alice Street in downtown Oakland. And you can buy tickets on brownpapertickets.com, and that's event 287-281, 287-281. And tickets are $20 in advance, $25 at the door, and $30 for reserved seats. So, again, it's going to be really fantastic. So we're going to close today's show with one more piece from Val Sarant, and here it is, A-Z-I-D-A-N-I-W-A. Azizi Daniwa.
Rwanda,
Libation for Babatunde Olatunde. Peace and blessings.